Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, episode 74, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Jerry. Wait, where's Al?
So, Al's had some personal stuff. We've bumped recording this episode a couple of times already, and Al had some personal stuff that cropped up at the last minute, so he wasn't able to make it tonight. But Jerry and I are going to do our absolute best to manfully run the... Yeah, fill in for his shoes. So in this show, we're going to talk about DevOps, and we're also going to take a question from our lovely audience.
We also talk about testing our environments, especially with infrastructure as code. So without further ado, let's get on with the show.
In our Telegram channel, I recently mentioned that we were going to start trying to do a listener Q&A section and invited anyone that was in the Telegram channel, which incidentally, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably should consider it, if they wanted to submit some questions for us to answer. Now, that's not to say we're going to know the answer to everything, because I think it's been quite clear in the past that we don't, but we are quite good at sort of noodling around things and finding bits and pieces out. So one of our amazing listeners, a nice guy called Mike, I mentioned that he works in a predominantly Windows environment, but he works on a Linux machine. So he works in a school. They've got Windows 7 on the desktops with Server 2012, which uses Active Directory and Group Policy. And what he's saying is that the admin is the admin of that part of the network is outsourced to an to a managed service provider who provide remote support and drop in every now and then. But he's using Linux exclusively, and he's now trying to work out, because they've got a password expiry policy, and every 90 days everyone changes their password. Every 90 days he loses access to his Windows drives. And he wants to know if there's any way of resetting the Windows password without actually having to log into Windows. So there's a couple of options here that I've come across, and Jerry's got a couple of answers as well. One thing that I've found is that you can attach a Linux machine to a Kerber to an Active Directory domain. Now, I've tried doing it in the past, and it's not dreadfully easy, and particularly if your MSP is not particularly comfortable with doing that, you might struggle with that one a little bit. But if you don't want to join your Linux machine to the domain, then there is just a command that you can run just with the SIFS tools. And that command is SMB password, SMB PASSWD. And we're going to stick some notes in the show notes about this one. That seems to be the least friction option, particularly if you're used to working in a command line. But Jerry, you said you'd spotted some other tools that might be useful.
Yeah, so there's PWM, which is I believe is a Java-based tool, and I've seen that used with Active Directory rather than Active Directory, but they are effectively the same sort of thing underneath, and also the project page says it supports Active Directory, so you could give that a go. I saw it hooked up to like a web front end, so that people could just go to the site and change their passwords that way.
Yeah, and in the same way, there is another link that I spotted, which was a tool called Passcore. And again, we'll provide links to both PWM and Passcore. And that seems to be a single page web application. So if you've got a web server running on your network already, then it's a C# application, and it'll talk to your Active Directory domain controller and let you reset your password through a web interface. So yeah, so you've got a few different options there. Plus we also just found I found a sample Reddit page that provided some other options as well. I must admit I haven't looked particularly in depth in those, particularly as we'd already come across a few options, but there are some options for you.
Yeah, so give those a go. It might, if you're Linux based and haven't come across something like that before, maybe look into LDAP and well, it's a big subject and it can be quite confusing on the command line, but that's kind of where you need to be looking if you're a Linux person who hasn't come across Active Directory before, because that's the equivalent on Linux. And like I say, the Active Directory is basically using these open source tools under the hood, by the from that's anecdotal, actually. I heard that somewhere, but I'm pretty sure it's fairly true.
So to clarify slightly, they're not open source tools under the hood. The LDAP that they're using, it's an open protocol LDAP, but it's not based on one of the existing LDAP protocols. Likewise, they're using Kerberos as the authentication mechanism. And whilst, again, Kerberos is an open protocol, and as I said, you can get, for the Linux heads out there, that you can get PAM modules that talk Kerberos, and that's particularly what you, I think you use a tool called SSSP to do Kerberos authentication between your Linux machine and your Windows domain.
Yeah. Or is it SSSD?
Oh, sorry, SSSD.
Or maybe that's the demon.
No, I think you're right. It is SSSD. So you can use SSSD to authenticate from your Linux machine to your Active Directory domain. And then in the back end, the way that Active Directory itself identifies what groups people are in and things like that, that's when they use the LDAP. So the LDAP is almost like an interface for tools like Exchange and group policy and things like that to work out what groups people are in.
For a kind of almost user-friendly LDAP experience on Linux, you could look at FreeIPA. It's been implemented at work, and we've been looking at the implementation and trying to work out how it works recently. So once I know a bit more about that, I can report that in a future episode.
Fantastic. So what I will say is, as I mentioned, we are looking for more of these questions, just as a, you know, couple of lines just to ask us a few things, a few bits and pieces about system administration on Windows, on Linux, cloud administration, anything that you think we know about, feel free to ask us a question. We'll see what we can do to help you. And that should go to the usual address of show@admin-podcast.co.uk. In our last episode, we talked a bit about test-driven development and behavior-driven development. We were talking about web applications. But one of the things that came up in that was we mentioned about using tools like InSpec and RSpec. And that's predominantly for what we refer to as infrastructure as code, test-driven infrastructure as code. Jerry, you tend to do a lot more with building infrastructure than I do. So have you done any of this test-driven infrastructure as code?
Yeah. So I first came across this a couple of years ago now. So when you write your infrastructure code, you want to have a way of, I mean, the infrastructure code is supposed to do a bunch of things, you know, if you're configuring a daemon on your server, then you'll write the infrastructure code to handle that. And it'll just go off and do its thing. And then hopefully you have a machine that's configured in the correct way. But there are ways of testing if the code has actually done what it's supposed to. Because if you do an Ansible run, it may have completed, and it may have all completed without any errors, but the service might still not be running, for instance. So you can do with InSpec, you can write code to say, this port should be open. Even if I run curl against this port, it should give me a specific response, or this string should be in the response, and that sort of thing. You know, a file should be in place at a particular path, and that sort of thing. So what InSpec lets you do is it lets you very easily and very in very sort of plain English terms write the code to check that sort of thing. So I mean, why would you need this, or in what kind of situation might you need this? One of those things, and I think that's probably true for non-infrastructure code as well, is if you have multiple people working on a bit of code, you write the test for what you want the code to do, and then you write the code to match the test. Or if someone comes along later and changes the code, the test should still run and should still be valid. So that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely the experience I've got from web development world, is that, you know, you you design your environment, your whole development environment, in such a way that anything that anyone submits to you should either be, you should be able to tell if they've broken something. Now, it's not always possible. So, for example, I was talking to somebody a few years back about sort of developing unit tests for some network orientated code he'd written. And he said, yeah, but it's very hard to mock up the response from an IRC server. And I went, oh, yeah, I suppose it is really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Likewise, I mean, so tools like InSpec, and I think you also mentioned there was a thing called RSpec, which is very similar.
I think RSpec is a bit sort of general Ruby testing library or module or whatever they're called in Ruby. And InSpec is a version specifically for infrastructure.
Right, okay.
So yeah, I know you were saying, but your friend saying about mocking up an IRC response.
Oh, yeah. So he was writing some code that should send a message to an IRC server. And he said it's because it's quite difficult to have, you know, if you're writing application software, you don't want to have to also be able to write an IRC server to then accept a connection request and then have it do authentication and then have it send a message, when actually what you want to do is just be able to say, I can talk to an IRC server.
I guess in that situation, you go as far as saying what port does the IRC server run on, and is that port listening? And if there was a way of getting, I don't know much about IRC, unfortunately, but if there was a way that you could ping it and get a pong back or a specific string back, then
yeah,
that would be enough.
No, I agree, but I mean, it was a facetious comment, to be fair, but yes, I know what you mean. It's one of those things where if you're developing, so as the bulk of what we now know as the internet is based around what you know, 99% of the people that use the internet see, which is HTTP based applications. And what a lot of people tend to forget is there's a whole lot of glue underneath that lot, whether it's Active Directory and Kerberos like we were talking before, or IRC or Telegram or stuff like that, that runs kind of parallel to these web services. You know, SMTP is another perfect example. These are all things that typical users don't understand the complexity of.
No. I mean, I should say, as an admin, I sometimes just accept that something works until it's broken and I have to fix it. Then that's when you find out more about this kind of thing, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Generally on a Friday afternoon, if you're unlucky.
In the InSpec stuff that you've done, winding the subject back a little bit.
Yeah.
So I've had a little bit of a look at InSpec, and I've not really done much with it. But typically, would you say, you know, things like this file is owned by this person, you know, this port is open, and this service is listening to it?
Yeah. So, I mean, to take a file is quite a simple and easily understandable thing to talk about. I mean, if I just read out this example, I'm not going to read out all the brackets and so on, but so describe file path, and then obviously you put path in there, do, and then it's literally it should, its content should match a regular expression. So, and then the end for the end of the for loop in Ruby. So just reading out there, it's really easy for a sort of layperson to understand. And actually, I've heard in the past on other podcasts about someone getting into the sysadmin ops side of things from writing these InSpec rules, or I think they're called controllers. They would write, or they would be tasked to write this stuff, like, you know, write these tests. And then from there, they kind of went into ops, DevOps, sysadmin stuff from that side of things. So it just goes to show how easy it is really to comprehend, I suppose.
In your experience, would you typically run InSpec on the host you were testing, would you run it on a CI/CD pipeline against a VM, or would you do it somewhere else?
So it's run, I believe, on the hosts. Where I've seen it used is a CI/CD system. Where I was actually doing most of the work on it, there was no CI/CD, so I was running the tests myself using Test Kitchen, and that was using Ansible Remote, so Ansible to build the test VM. And then Test Kitchen itself would invoke these tests. Test Kitchen is a framework from Chef. Basically, it will build a VM or Docker container or whatever, and then run tests against it and then destroy the container. So that is to be used in a CI pipeline, you know, build, provision, test and destroy with the four steps, I believe. So yeah, it would be used it would be basically pointed at whatever VM was built. And I think that's all done through some kind of API in Test Kitchen, as I remember it. It was quite a while ago. It's done through whatever mechanism builds the test VM or container in the first place.
Off air, well, you and I have talked about Test Kitchen a couple of times in the past, and I've always kind of looked at it and got a bit confused, because it seems to be that Test Kitchen was developed by the Chef people with Chef.
Yeah.
And it seems to be very focused towards Chef, but you then said that you were using it with Ansible. So how does that work?
The nitty gritty of it, I've forgotten.
All right,
a while ago. But if you've ever used Vagrant, there's like a notion of a provider, are they called in mm-hmm. Vagrant?
Yep.
So you can get Vagrant, I think by default, it talks to VirtualBox, but you can make it talk to, for instance, KVM or AWS again, or DigitalOcean or anything mm-hmm. like that. And in the same way, the provisioner, you can swap out the provisioner. So you can use Ansible instead of Chef, probably Puppet, things like Puppet and Salt and that kind of thing as well. It's easy to swap out because I've done it, but as for the ins and outs of it, I would have to talk about it in a future podcast.
No, that's good.
But it just abstracts away the, you know, build this container or whatever, and then run this stuff. And it lets you put it into a CI pipeline in a nice, easy way.
So I'm actually thinking of a specific use case at work now. So, because I hadn't realized we were going to go down this route. Do you know if one of the providers you can use is like AWS or Azure, or
you can definitely use it. And I've got drivers here. Yeah, so EC2. I mean, it's EC2 specifically because you're working on the level of an instance or a container. We've got DigitalOcean, Dokken, which is Docker, Google, Hyper-V, Azure. So yeah, there's all of the major ones are covered. Yeah,
looks like I know what I'm doing this weekend.
and yeah, specifically we were using it at this place with AWS. So go for it.
Fantastic. I think I'll be pinging you somewhat on the Telegram group.
Yeah, I might have to refresh my memory. I think when we were doing the prep for the show, I'd put this thing in the show notes or the back show notes show topics backlog in January 2018. So,
fair enough.
I'm a bit rusty, hence the hesitation.
No worries. One of the things that came out of that conversation though was you mentioned the word DevOps. And
yes,
and you and I are both kind of vaguely aware of sort of, well, I say vaguely, we're both aware of DevOps. But one of the things that was quite clear with some of our conversations with other people we've spoken to in the past is that actually DevOps is sometimes seen as a bit of a dirty word, and you and I both think that it probably isn't. My experience with DevOps, particularly in large enterprise, is that actually most of the people don't understand what it is, particularly management. and salespeople will look at it and think that it's something you can kind of, it's something you can buy. It's something that you can just, the main bugbear that I have with it is people say, here's our suite of DevOps tools. Mm. And it's like, that's not a thing. In fact, for quite a long while, my job title actually said DevOps engineer. And I was like, no, that's not right. So it is a buzzword.
Yeah.
Engineers frequently also don't understand what DevOps is. They might look at it as being, you know, people trying to steal my jobs, or, you know, not steal my jobs, but like, you know, trying to headcount and stuff like that. What do you see it as, Jerry? How's it come exposed itself in your sort of world?
Talking about it being a buzzword, the thing that springs to mind is that cloud was a buzzword for quite a while, a few years ago. But I think we, like both of us certainly, would probably understand now what cloud actually means. I mean, to me, it's a virtualization system with an API that runs, doesn't run on-premise. You know, that's basically what it means to me. I don't think it's that simple with DevOps, but in a way it does. You can have DevOps tooling because there are lots of tools around now that didn't exist, say, 7 years ago, because they definitely existed 5 years ago. Well, they did exist, but they weren't in mainstream use. But it's also, to me, coming to mean a way of working in a technical context, whereby the people that run the systems, that what would have been called the sysadmins in the past, and the people using the systems, in most cases developers, are working more closely together or working in a certain way, which means that the pace at which things happen increases, and that has probably spawned these tools. So I'm thinking my sort of way into it is configuration management, and configuration management existed 20, 30 years ago, but it was a bunch of scripts that the admins had written to automate things, rather than, if you like, a sort of framework that these config management tools can let you do those things with. And that's come out of the demands of, you know, this increased velocity of working.
So I think for me, that for those that have never kind of experienced a DevOps sort of culture environment, you can get DevOps tools and things like that. For me, my view of it is that DevOps is actually just a way of looking at a resourcing problem. So typically, when you as a systems admin are given a set of servers to manage, for example, and this especially happens in large organizations, but I'm sure it happens in smaller ones as well, you'd have a team of network engineers whose sole responsibility was for the stack of switches and routers. And they might also be responsible for sort of the network security appliances, so your firewalls and your IPS and your proxies maybe. And then you'd have a different set of people that looked after your server farm. So that you'd have your, what we used to call your ops staff, that would be in the data center. And so it would be their job to sort of walk around the data center and make sure that all the backup drives had tapes in them, and make sure that all the servers had no warning lights on the front. And they were responsible for, you know, if the power failed, checking to make sure that all the kit was still running, and if you needed lights out. Anyway, so it's that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then you'd have the people that ran the operating system, and they'd make sure that it was patched and the right users had access and the connectivity was right. And then you'd have people that looked after the applications, and all of these would be different teams. And whilst they knew each other and potentially even worked quite well together, they weren't in the same team. And a lot of the DevOps stuff comes from a lot of the agile processes, where they're trying to change the way that you work on something, where you value the connections between people more than necessarily the the documentation or the contracts of how things are going to work. It's about getting things working quicker. And so one way that you move away from kind of these silos of people who aren't working together is that where you might have had 15 people in a networks team or 5 people and 15 system admins or 5 sysadmins, what you would end up doing is on a project, you would bring one of those network people in and you'd bring one of the sysadmin people in and you'd bring one of the apps people in and you'd have them working together. So everything that you need to run that particular application, start working together towards that application as a whole. Now, it might not be their own only job, typically they would be all involved together towards the delivery and ongoing maintenance of that server.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard this sort of multidisciplinary teams. Is that the sort of way it's described? Yeah, so you would have like a service effectively looked after by or built by these people and maintained and kept running by these team of people who will have sort of different skill sets.
The other thing that I've heard people say is their expectation is that if you've got a multidisciplinary team, it doesn't mean that the people in that team lose their unique set of skills. So the networking person doesn't stop being a networking person. He may have primary responsibility for it, but one of the things that he should be doing So it's not so much for physical anymore, but you know, when you're looking at, say, for example, cloud, the person that stood up the network and the security parts of, say, for example, your Azure or your AWS cloud should also be able to explain to the guy that runs the server how he stood that up. And he potentially should have some scripts or some automated processes that he's put in place. So that if, for example, your whole environment dies at 2 o'clock in the morning and that networks person isn't there, somebody else from that interdisciplinary team should be able to reprovision that element of the service. They should be able to make changes to it outside of that.
This is where infrastructure as code becomes very important.
Absolutely.
To be honest, we've seen a lot of that where I'm working at the moment. If you stand something up, it has to be in an infrastructure as code way, because then people can tell how you've done it, you know, as far as possible. And the other thing is when you change something, it's peer reviewed. So if you're using something like GitHub, it's a pull request, or GitLab as we're using, it's a merge request. They're the same thing, but. And that shows you what code is being changed, and from that you can basically surmise what is actually being changed in the system. So everyone's on the same page, like you say, and whoever gets woken up at 3 a.m. has some idea what was changed, and might even be a commit close to the time when things started breaking. So that can also help.
The other thing as well, that DevOps culture. So for me, that's more what it is. It's not a set of tools. It's not a set of processes. It's not even something that you can go away and learn. It's a culture. It's something that your management needs to buy into. They need to be able to see the benefit of having these multidisciplinary teams, this kind of way of working that brings kind of the different strands of tech experiences together. But what comes out of the back of that is you get I've completely lost my thread of what I was going to say there.
Is it the sort of increased velocity that I was talking about earlier? That's a kind of a side effect.
Cattle and pets was where I was going with it.
Right.
By buying into this culture of understanding how these multidisciplinary teams can work together, and by using infrastructure as code, you can start to get to a point where you're not worried so much about individual machines. As a network security person, I might have an individual virtual machine that I run tests against. And this is where that test kitchen thing we were talking about before is really interesting to me. You know, you might stand a machine up to run your infrastructure as code tests against, then perhaps run some smoke tests, some tests through it that have got a certain pattern of traffic or traffic profile that you like the look of. But that infrastructure is only there just for long enough to run your tests, and then you blow it away. What you're more likely to have is clusters of machines that you can take individual machines out of the cluster, do something with them, put them back, or take individual machines out, destroy it, and build new ones.
Yeah. I mean, that's tended to be the way people have gone with this, is towards what's called immutable infrastructure, or disposable infrastructure, sometimes called, where you build... So you build this VM, which you run your tests against, your automated tests, in a CI pipeline, and then you can do something like, so if the tests pass, build this image, and then at a given time deploy a VM from that image, because you know it's going to work because of all the tests passed in that CI job. Obviously, that'll only work for a stateless machine, really. If you've got any kind of state held, that kind of has to be decoupled in that scenario. But yeah, that's an example of I guess people, and that's the ultimate cattle versus pets kind of setup, because you can cookie cutter as many of those images as you need to make things work.
So one of the things that some of our listeners might be looking at this and sort of trying to figure out what it means to them. If you are in your sort of standard working life, if you're currently a sysadmin, you know, one of those siloed, non-multifunctional people, if your firm's coming to you and saying, we want to do DevOps, there's a great article where, I don't know whether if you actually remember it, Jerry, were you ever aware of a thing called Geek Code? Do you remember that?
Yeah, well, as in... The Geek Code, or
where you'd have sort of a signature that said, you know,
but certain, many years ago,
certain sort of uppercase and lowercase letters and stuff like that
would
indicate, you know, is it, you know, are you, you know, for Babylon 5 or against it, and, you know, were you a Star Trek fan or a, you know, Deep Space Nine or whatever. But there's a similar thing about how DevOps are you, and it's, you know, which letters do you capitalize can indicate, you know, just how far DevOps you are. Now, I definitely had something about that in my blog, so I'll have to dig out the link to that. But there are certain aspects to what people think DevOps is. So, for example, one thing that you tend to hear a lot in DevOps is about failing fast, and that's again a lot of this thing to do with velocity and working closely together, infrastructure as code. But what people tend to fail to realize about failing fast is that it's not about the failing. Although failing is important, actually, if you've failed at something, what you've actually done is you've run some tests and proved that something didn't work. So, for example, I had a manager that quite publicly on stage, when he had spent 15 minutes talking about how awesome being agile was, the interviewer mentioned something about failing fast, and he responded with something along the lines of, well, actually, I think you'll find I'd rather not fail at all. And it's just like, oh, you've clearly bought the agile bandwagon, the DevOps bandwagon, and not actually read what it was you were buying into. Otherwise, you wouldn't have answered it in that way. But again, he's management. He's not. You can't always expect somebody that's not technical to understand why that's. Anyway, I'm waffling quite badly now.
But it's like all software has bugs. It doesn't matter what the software is. There'll always be bugs there, and they're not known until you find them. And I think DevOps probably goes hand in hand with cloud, two buzzwords together sort of thing. But if you've got a cloud infrastructure, more often than not, it's a quite a big distributed system, any part of which can fail at any time. So one of the sort of mantras I've heard recently is embracing failure. So when something fails, not if something fails, you find out exactly why it's failed. You look at your monitoring, because that's another big part of the whole way of working. And you can then, you effectively put in a bug fix for the failure. It's just that the failure is often more substantial than just some bit of bug in the code that's running, because it's infrastructure, and as we all know, infrastructure can go wrong fast, and distributed infrastructure can go wrong even faster.
So one of the things that I've seen that helps towards kind of determining how at risk you are with things like that is there's a set of tools that I think Netflix originally wrote called Chaos Monkey.
Oh yeah.
And Chaos Monkey, I think, was originally designed to just be able to tell how resilient your network was to failure. So, for example, one of the things that Chaos Monkey will do is you give it rights to go away and talk to, say, for example, you're working with AWS or Azure or something like that. You can make it go around and shut down individual servers, and you just see what happens. So, for example, you know, does a failure in one machine out of your network result in a production outage? And so one of the things that you can also do as well is you can have what they call game days. And there's a Twitter account that I've seen that gives you some game day scenarios, for example, where you can, you know, things that is mostly security stuff, but, you know, things like one of your network engineers has lost their production laptop, logged in on the train. What do you do?
Yeah, right.
You know, your CFO has had his password safe cracked, and he now has the root credentials for your AWS account. What do you do?
Right.
You know, it's things like that. And again, infrastructure, I mean, we've banged this drum pretty heavily in this game, in this particular episode. But, you know, if you've got the resources to spin up almost like a replica of your production environment, then you can run game days. You can run stuff like Chaos Monkey without impacting your production traffic. But actually, if you've got enough infrastructure in place to be able to support game days, Chaos Monkey, then run these tools against your network in a production during the working day when everyone's there. Maybe pick a time when your impacted traffic is likely to be less, or perhaps take some machines out of production and run your tests against those.
Yeah, maybe start off with a Chaos Monkey environment, which, you know, like a dev environment, which the general public can't see. And then once you've designed for resilience, maybe put it into production.
Yeah, but it's definitely something to look at. But yeah, so as a system administrator, definitely don't be afraid of DevOps. At the very least, you have the potential to be learning new skills in technologies that you're not already working in. So, for example, as a sysadmin, you might learn some programming skills, you might learn some networking skills, you might learn some security tools. As a networking engineer, you might learn some more about operating systems, you might learn some more about applications, and, you know, some of the stacks, some of the levels, you know, layer 3, sort of getting down towards layer 4, 5, 6, and 7. You know, as an application guy, you might start picking up more about the operating system. You might start picking up a little bit more about networks.
Yeah, I mean, I think I phrased it in the show notes as get your dirty dev mitts off my precious servers from a sysadmin point of view. It's really not, in my mind, it's really not about that. I mean, I have seen developers do some silly things, maybe, but it's really because they didn't know any better. and in a multidisciplinary team, they would pick that up straight away when you leaned over to their desk and told them they shouldn't be doing that, rather than it's sort of you know, oh god, these developers have done something stupid again. So it's more about that than letting the developers loose on the servers and anything that might entail. I mean, I should say as well that my work environment before about four years ago or so, 3 or 4 years ago, I was more end user support, I would say, than working with developers specifically. Although they were doing some sort of very, it was basically COBOL programming in a lot of cases. So they were kind of programming, but it was programming jobs for a batch processing system rather than in COBOL rather than anything you might find these days. The whole notion of working with devs is a bit new to me.
One of the other things that a lot of people that are currently working in large production enterprises is they're used to their ITSM tool sets. So things like your ServiceNow, your Remedies, your Peregrine, your change management systems that basically, you know, you've built up years and years and years of, you know, somebody made a change at 3:30 on a Friday afternoon and it's taken out production and customers are screaming, therefore you're never allowed to make changes on a Friday afternoon anymore. So then you put in a change planning system that says, you know, you can only put changes in, you know, Monday to Thursday, 6 PM to 4 AM to make sure you don't disturb production during working hours. And then you start having like large processes and procedures, almost like a ritual that says, oh, you know, to make a change to system ABC123, you need to have three representatives from the server team and, you know, two network engineers and
sacrifice chicken.
Indeed, sacrifice chicken, you know, make sure that the rain dance was done, all those sorts of things. You know, I've even seen what in one case you had to have a full weather system check before you start making a change, because if they'd had a lightning strike on one halfway through the change once and it took out the generators. If you start going down that route, people find DevOps really scary.
It's a lot of the time it's about release cadence and how often you release.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your software, which in a lot of places it's down to every half an hour or something like that. That's more on the code side than the infrastructure side, though. I have to say, it's like I'd still be wary of making infrastructure changes that regularly on a Friday afternoon.
So interestingly, I did see a thing on Twitter not very long ago that basically said, you know, if you are blocking out half of one day a week, that's 1/14 of your working career that you can't be making any changes. And if you're saying that you can't work 1/14 of your working career, what are you doing in that time? And this is where those things like Chaos Monkey and Game Days and stuff like that come back to help you. You know, because if you can prove that taking out an entire VPC or a VPN doesn't impact your operations, or if it does, that you've got stuff that's in place to root around that, then you're in a much better situation. But the other thing as well that can help with things like that is a thing that I've come across called GitOps, which is effectively, if you've got a change management system that relies on having, you know, an in place configuration management database and, you know, full knowledge of the entire infrastructure and what's installed where and stuff like that, GitOps kind of can help quite significantly with that, because what's in your environment is what's in your Git repository. And particularly, as you mentioned before, you know, you have a pull request or a merge request that says, you know, I want to add this piece of software, I want to add this release, I want to start running that particular instance of a machine. What is in live should mirror your head branch of your Git repository. So you go from having a change management system where everyone's kind of loosely aware of what your infrastructure looks like to having everyone being able to look through your Git history to see exactly what changed, when it changed, why it changed, particularly if you've got a CI/CD system that can show, you know, yes, this is the release that we pushed out to all the servers at 2:00 on a, you know, Tuesday morning. And this is the version we pushed out at 2:15 on the Tuesday morning. You know, you've got your full working Git infrastructure that tells you what changed, when it changed, and why it changed.
Bears reading.
It does indeed. Yeah. Now, coming back from stuff like that, I mentioned before about having something in, you know, being able to test what's in production and being able to mirror that in a sort of a non-live environment. You were talking about synchronizing between live and dev in a sensible way.
Yeah, so this is sort of an unsolved problem from my point of view. I've got a couple of simple infrastructure, really, a web server and a database server running WordPress, and there's a live and a dev environment. So I'm happy making changes, Ansible type changes on dev and then on live, and then making those same changes on live. But with WordPress being an application, it's LAMP, Apache, MySQL, PHP, although you can run it on Nginx as well. And it's basically a load of web files and a database, and that needs syncing from when the work has been done in dev, that needs syncing up to the live environment. And I haven't really got a satisfactory way of doing this at the moment. It's all very manual. So one of the difficulties is that the database has URLs in the database. So based on the URL that the WordPress instance is running on. So there's a script I'm using to do search and replace on those terms. But at the moment, it's a manual process. You've got to basically take a database dump in the way I'm doing it at the moment, take a database dump, somehow get that to the live, that database dump to the live environment, import it into the live database, and then run the script to change the search terms. And then you've got to get some maybe hundreds of megabytes of files across at the same time. I haven't got a CI system running, so which would be an obvious way of doing that, basically a way to automate that process. And so I just wondered, John, if you had any ideas, or if our listeners did actually, about how to achieve this.
So let me play back something that you just said there in my head. You've got a dev environment, and you're trying to replicate the changes you make in dev into live. It's predominantly database changes. Is that right?
Well, it's web files or, assets, basically.
So it's the combination of the two.
Yeah, and database, and you've also got this search and replace thing going on.
So one of the things that you could do, potentially, is perhaps have, in the way that you have your export, potentially what you could be doing is having that as something like an Ansible job or something similar that actually calls a web page on your dev environment that can do the inline rewrite of your exported data. Your assets should all be generated as part of your Ansible playbooks or your Puppet, Chef, whatever you've got that are generating that, especially if you're using something like Bower or this is where my lack of knowledge of current web tools comes into.
Oh, you're thinking, is it Gulp?
Gulp is the other one, yeah. Where, they're basically squashing, minimizing, minifying, and, things like that. Your assets, they should be relatively standard stuff that you're doing out of line anyway. What is effectively in your dev should also mirror what's in your Git repository, for sake of argument.
Well, I mean, these are more binary files, which you can't put in Git. So that's the issue. Really. If it was code, then that would be fairly easy. But yeah, we've got binary files. So one idea that I had was I'm actually developing the backup system using Restic, which we talked about last time. Mm-hmm. So the idea was to just create a backup, which would be in a third area. So like you say, you could do the search and replace in the dev on the dev machine, effectively, for the data, search and replace in the database, dump it out, and then have the machine back up to the backup repository, and then pull from that repository on the live server. It does seem like it should be a solved problem, this, though. So I'm curious if anyone else has grappled with this.
So I know that in a similar circumstance, I was working with an encryption at rest provider, and they had a way that they were working with database tables. When you wrote to the database, you were actually calling a stored procedure that effectively put the component parts that would change into their own columns. The things that changed between live and dev were in tables, and then you'd use a view to stick those pieces back together again.
Right.
Now, they were using that particularly where, say, for example, you had a person's name, but that person's name you wanted to encrypt. What they would actually do is the function that you would call to inject into the table would actually do the encryption in flight. So as you injected it, encrypted it then. And then when you called it back out, depending on which user you used to request the table, would either permit you to decrypt or would not.
Right.
On the machine you were coming from and things like that. But it sounds like that's probably something that would be quite useful to you here, is actually making it so that when you, if you're saying you're storing URLs that are dependent between prod and dev, why not in your code that takes that URL actually split it out so that just the component part that's valid is stored? I mean, that's a big change, but...
Yeah, I think that is just how WordPress does it, and I don't think that can be changed. I mean, part of the problem with this is as well is that WordPress, if you Google for an answer, you get answers from a WordPress user's point of view. And I've seen WordPress plugins that have been written that in the documentation for the plugin says to make this work, all the permissions should be 777, which is a little bit scary. So... And many WordPress developers, I'm sure there's some very technically adept WordPress developers, but there's many of them on the internet that recommend, oh, everything works if you change it to 777. So it's hard to find a sort of streamlined solution for this, but I'll keep looking and report back, or indeed if anyone's got any ideas or has done this, then with WordPress specifically, I'd be all ears.
Fair enough then. So apparently all of my answers are not helpful.
Well, I mean, it's good, yeah, given me something to think about, but I think sort of changing the database layout is not something that would work with WordPress as far as I'm aware. But yeah, we'll keep looking.
Fair enough.
But thanks. I definitely value your input, John, as always.
Well, talking of valuing input, I think we're getting towards the end of this show. It's very odd not having Al with us, and I hope that the situations that have caused him to miss us aren't with us for going forward.
Mm.
As always, we must thank our Patreons, and Jerry seems to do a fantastic job of relaying out our list. So, Jerry, over to you.
We'd like to thank Andamo, Yannick and Dave as our Patreons. Thanks, guys. It's amazing. You're doing amazing stuff by giving us money.
I want to mention again some of the forthcoming events. So, well, I say the forthcoming events. There's only one really to mention now, which is OggCamp, which will be on Saturday the 19th and Sunday the 20th of October. There is a call for papers that is currently running at the time of this recording. As to whether or not it will still be running following that, I don't know. So if you go to papercall.io/OggCamp2019, so that's papercall, PAPERCALL. .io/OggCamp, that's OGGCAMP 2019. You can submit your talks for the main stage. OggCamp is a collaboration culture conference, or at least that's what we called it last year. I don't know if that's still the terminology they're using this year. Promoting all things, you know, free software, open source, Creative Commons, but free culture, free software, open source, all those sorts of fun things, Creative Commons. And if you want to come to the event in October, you can have a look on oggcamp.org. That's oggcamp.org.
First Talk Live is on the 8th of June. I'm sure you've heard it elsewhere, sort of from the horse's mouth, as it were. Sorry, Joe. That it's sold out, but it's in a pub, and you might be able to get down to see the talks if you go along, or there might be some tickets from people who have got tickets. The tickets are free, but can't go, so they've returned them. So it's worth popping along if you're in the area. It's, I believe, King's Cross, the Harrison near King's Cross, which is a lovely little pub. Pretty quiet for a London pub, and yeah, very nice.
So I would like to welcome any of our new listeners. It's been mentioned in a few places that we are rapidly picking up new listeners. So thank you very much to anyone that is new. Please feel free to tell your friends. If you can leave feedback on things like iTunes, Gpodder and stuff like that, then that would be fantastic. And if you want to talk to some of the other podcast listeners, we do have a Telegram channel, and the link for that, I believe, is on our website.
Yeah, and I should also say you can talk to the podcast hosts in that Telegram channel.
Yes.
Although I tend to only read it every once in a while. So I'll give you a load of replies all at once to questions you might have asked weeks ago.
So very much like IRC, if you are old school enough to remember IRC, we do have a few lurkers, and the podcast hosts are amongst those lurkers. So I try and join in as and when I can, but much like Jerry and Al, I have a rather full professional and personal life. So we join in when we can, but we do have lots of fantastic members of the community that are also there and joining in. I particularly want to mention Andy and Paul, who I think are probably the top talkers aside from us in the channel. But there are some fantastic other members in there, particularly Mike as well, who, as I mentioned before, responded to our appeal for listener questions. Talking of that, if you have got any questions, or if you've got any feedback about this show, please feel free to email show@admin.podcast.co.uk, and we can either address the queries in this next show or the next shows, or perhaps field stuff out to our Telegram channel, or maybe just reply to you and say, nope, haven't got a clue on that one. I do want to mention that the Patreon that we mentioned before, Dave, who is also our producer, does a fantastic job. I don't think we could do this podcast without him. So thank you very much, Dave.
Definitely. Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
If you want to be a Patreon like Dave, who I just mentioned, Yannick and Adamo, you can go along to our website, admin.podcast.co.uk, and follow the links to the Patreon site there as well. And so with that, I think we are pretty much done. What do you think, Jerry?
Yeah, I think so. So see you next time.
See you next time. Ta-ta.
Bye. Now it's all.